So you have, and I have repaid you by good treatment. I have left your ship undisturbed and treated you with every consideration. Yet you fall short. Freely offered information, for instance, on your gadgets might have been helpful. The atomic principles on which they are built would seem to be used in some of the Foundation's nastiest weapons, right? I'm only a trader, said Devers, and not one of these bigwig technicians. I sell this stuff. I don't make it. Well, that will be seen shortly. It is what I came here for. For instance, your ship will be searched for a personal force shield. You have never worn one, yet all soldiers of the Foundation do. It will be significant evidence that there is information you do not choose to give me. Right? There was no answer. He continued, and there will be more direct evidence. I have brought with me the psychic probe. It failed once before, but contact with the enemy is a liberal education. His voice was smoothly threatening, and Devers felt the gun thrust hard in his midriff. The general's gun, hitherto in its holster. The general said quietly, "You will remove your wristband and any other metal ornaments you wear and give them to me. Slowly. Atomic fields can be distorted, you see, and psychic probes might probe only into static." "That's right. I'll take it." The receiver on the general's desk was glowing, and a message capsule clicked into the slot, near which Barr stood and still held the trimensional Imperial bust. Rio stepped behind his desk with his blast gun held ready. He said to Barr, "You too, Patrician. Your wristband condemns you. You have been helpful earlier, however, and I am not vindictive. But I shall judge the fate of your behostaged family by the results of the psychic probe." And as Rios leaned over to take out the message capsule, Barr lifted the crystal-enveloped bust of Cleon and quietly and methodically brought it down upon the general's head. It happened too suddenly for Devers to grasp. It was as if a sudden demon had grown into the old man. "Out," said Barr, in a tooth-clenched whisper. "Quickly!" He seized Rios's dropped blaster and buried it in his blouse. Sergeant Look turned as they emerged from the narrowest possible crack of the door. Barr said easily, "Lead on, Sergeant." Devers closed the door behind him. Sergeant Look led in silence to their quarters, and then, with the briefest pause, continued onward, for there was the nudge of a blast gun muzzle in his ribs, and a hard voice in his ears which said, "To the trade ship." Devers stepped forward to open the airlock, and Barr said, "Stand where you are, Look. You've been a decent man, and we're not going to kill you." But the sergeant recognized the monogram on the gun. He cried in choked fury, "You've killed the general!" With a wild, incoherent yell, he charged blindly upon the blasting fury of the gun and collapsed in blasted ruin. The trade ship was rising above a dead planet before the signal lights began their eerie blink, and against the creamy cobweb of the great lens in the sky, which was the galaxy, other black forms rose. Devers said grimly, "Hold tight, Barr, and let's see if they've got a ship that can match my speed." He knew they hadn't. And once in open space, the trader's voice seemed lost and dead as he said, "The line I fed Broderick was a little too good. It seems as if he's thrown in with the general." Swiftly, they raced into the depths of the star mass that was the galaxy. Chapter 8. To Trantor. Devers bent over the little dead globe, watching for a tiny sign of life. The directional control was slowly and thoroughly sieving space with its jabbing tight sheaf of signals. Barr watched patiently from his seat on the low cot in the corner. He asked, "No more signs of them? The Empire boys? Nah." The trader growled the words with evident impatience. "We lost the scuppers long ago. Space. With the blind jumps we took through hyperspace, it's lucky we didn't land up in a sun's belly. They couldn't have followed us even if they outranged us, which they didn't." He sat back and loosened his collar with a jerk. "I don't know what those Empire boys have done here. I think some of the gaps are out of alignment." "I take it then you're trying to get to the Foundation?"
"I'm calling the Association. We're trying to."
"The Association? Who are they?"
"Association of Independent Traders." "Never heard of it, huh? Well, you're not alone. We haven't made our splash yet." For a while, there was a silence that centered about the unresponsive reception indicator, and Barr said, "Are you within range?" "I don't know. I haven't but a small notion where we are, going by dead reckoning. That's why I have to use directional control. It could take years, you know." "Might it?" Barr pointed, and Devers jumped and adjusted his earphones. Within the little murky sphere, there was a tiny glowing whiteness. For half an hour, Devers nursed the fragile, groping thread of communication that reached through hyperspace to connect two points that laggard light would take 500 years to bind together. Then he sat back hopelessly. He looked up and shoved the earphones back. "Let's eat, Doc. There's a needle shower you can use if you want to, but go easy on the hot water." He squatted before one of the cabinets that lined one wall and felt through the contents. "You're not a vegetarian, I hope," Barr said. "I'm omnivorous. But what about the association? Have you lost them?" "Looks so. It was extreme range, a little too extreme. Doesn't matter, though. I got all that counted." He straightened and placed the two metal containers upon the table. "Just give it 5 minutes, Doc, then slit it open by pushing the contact. It'll be plate, food, and fork. Sort of handy for when you're in a hurry, if you're not interested in such incidentals as napkins. I suppose you want to know what I got out of the association, if it isn't a secret." Devers shook his head. "Not to you. What Rio said was true. About the offer of tribute?" "Uh-huh. They offered it, and had it refused. Things are bad. There's fighting in the Outer Sons of Loris. Loris is close to the Foundation?" "Huh? Oh, you wouldn't know. It's one of the original four kingdoms. You might call it part of the inner line of defense. And that's not the worst. They've been fighting large ships previously never been encountered, which means Rios wasn't giving us the works. He has received more ships. Broderick has switched sides, and I have messed things up." His eyes were bleak as he joined the food container contact points and watched it fall open neatly. The stew-like dish steamed its aroma through the room. Duke and Barr was already eating. "So much," said Barr, "for improvisations, then. We can do nothing here. We cannot cut through the Imperial lines to return to the Foundation. We can do nothing but that which is most sensible, to wait patiently. However, if Rios has reached the inner line, I trust the wait will not be too long." And Devers put down his fork. "Wait, is it?" he snarled, glowering. "That's all right for you. You've got nothing at stake." "Haven't I?" Barr smiled thinly. "No. In fact, I'll tell you." Devers' irritation skimmed the surface. "I'm tired of looking at this whole business as if it were an interesting something or other on a microscope slide. I got friends somewhere out there, dying. And a whole world out there, my home, dying also. You're an outsider. You don't know." "I have seen friends die." The old man's hands were limp in his lap, and his eyes were closed. "Are you married?" Devers said. "Traders don't marry." "Well, I have 2 sons and a nephew. They have been warned, but for reasons, they could take no action. Our escape means their death. My daughter and my 2 grandchildren have, I hope, left the planet safely before this. But even excluding them, I have already risked and lost more than you." Devers was morosely savage. "I know. But that was a matter of choice. You might have played ball with Rios. I never asked you to..." Barr shook his head. "It was not a matter of choice, Devers. Make your conscience free. I didn't risk my sons for you. I cooperated with Rios as long as I dared. But there was the psychic probe." The Sewenian patrician opened his eyes, and they were sharp with pain. "Rios came to me once. It was over 1 year ago. He spoke of a cult centering about the magicians, but missed the truth. It is not quite a cult. You see, it is 40 years now that Siwena has been gripped in the same unbearable vice that threatens your world. 5 revolts have been ground out. Then I discovered the ancient records of Harry Seldon, and now this cult waits. It waits for the coming of the magicians, and for that day it is ready. My sons are leaders of those who wait. It is that secret which is in my mind, and which the probe must never touch. And so they must die as hostages. For the alternative is their death as rebels, and half of Siwena with them. You see, I had no choice, and I am no outsider. Devers' eyes fell, and Barr continued softly. It is on a Foundation victory that Siwenna's hopes depend. It is for a Foundation victory that my sons are sacrificed. And Harry Seldon does not precalculate the inevitable salvation of Siwenna as he does that of the Foundation. I have no certainty for my people, only hope. But you're still satisfied to wait, even with the Imperial Navy at Loris? I would wait in perfect confidence, said Barr simply, if they had landed on the planet Terminus itself. The trader frowned hopelessly. I don't know. It can't really work like that. Not just like magic. Psychohistory or not, they're terribly strong and we're weak. Now what can Seldon do about it? There's nothing to do. It's all already done. It's proceeding now. Because you don't hear the wheels turning and the gongs beating doesn't mean it's any the less certain. Maybe. But I wish you had cracked Rios's skull for keeps. He's more the enemy than all his army. Cracked his skull? With Broderick his second in command? Barr's face sharpened with hate. All Siwenna would have been my hostage. Broderick has proven his worth long since. There exists a world which 5 years ago lost one male in every 10, and simply for failure to meet outstanding taxes. This same Broderick was the tax collector. No, Rios may live. His punishments are mercy in comparison. But 6 months, 6 months in the enemy base with nothing to show for it. Devers' strong hands clasped each other tautly, so that his knuckles cracked. Nothing to show for it. Well, now, wait. You remind me. Barr fumbled in his pouch. You might want to count this. And he tossed the small sphere of metal on the table. Devers snatched it. What is it? The message capsule. The one that Rios received just before I jacked him. Does that count as something? I don't know. Depends on what's in it. Devers sat down and turned it over carefully in his hand. When Barr stepped from his cold shower and gratefully into the mild, warm current of the air dryer, he found Devers silent and absorbed at the workbench. The Siwenian slapped his body with a sharp rhythm and spoke above the punctuating sounds. What are you doing? Devers looked up. Droplets of perspiration glittered in his beard. I'm going to open this capsule. Can you open it without Rios's personal characteristic? There was mild surprise in the Siwenian's voice. If I can't, I'll resign from the association and never skipper a ship for what's left of my life. I got a three-way electronic analysis of the interior now, and I got little jiggers that the Empire never heard of, specially made for jimmying capsules. I've been a burglar before this, you know. A traitor has to be something of everything. He bent low over the little sphere, and a small flat instrument probed delicately and sparked redly at each fleeting contact. He said, This capsule's a crude job anyway. These Imperial boys are no shakes at this small work, I can see that. Ever see a Foundation capsule? It's half the size and impervious to electronic analysis in the first place. And then he was rigid, the shoulder muscles beneath his tunic tautening visibly. His tiny probe pressed slowly. It was noiseless when it came, but Devers relaxed and sighed. In his hand was the shining sphere, with its message unrolled like a parchment tongue. It's from Broderick, he said. Then with contempt, the message medium is permanent. In a Foundation capsule, the message would be oxidized to gas within the minute. But Duke and Barr waved him silent. He read the message quickly. From Amal Broderick, Envoy Extraordinary of His Imperial Majesty, Privy Secretary of the Council and Peer of the Realm, to Bel Rios, Military Governor of Siwenna, General of the Imperial Forces and Peer of the Realm, I greet you. Planet number 1120 no longer resists. The plans of offense, as outlined, continue smoothly. The enemy weakens visibly and the ultimate ends in view will surely be gained. Barr raised his head from the almost microscopic print and cried bitterly, The fool! The forsaken blasted fop! That a message? Huh? Said Devers. He was vaguely disappointed. It says nothing, ground out Barr. Our lickspittle courtier is playing a general now.
With Rio's away, he is the field commander and must soothe his paltry spirit by spewing out his pompous reports concerning military affairs he has nothing to do with. So-and-so planet no longer resists. The offensive moves on. The enemy weakens. The vacuum-headed peacock. Well, now, wait a minute. Hold on. Throw it away. The old man turned away in mortification. A galaxy knows I never expected it to be world-shakingly important. But in wartime, it is reasonable to assume that even the most routine order left undelivered might hamper military movements and lead to complications later. It's why I snatched it. But this, better to have left it. It would have wasted a minute of Rios's time that will now be put to more constructive use. But Devers had arisen. Will you hold on and stop throwing your weight around, for Selden's sake? He held out the sliver of message before Barr's nose. Now read that again. What does he mean by ultimate ends in view? The conquest of the Foundation. Well? Yes? And maybe he means the conquest of the Empire. You know he believes that to be the ultimate end. And if he does, Devers' one-sided smile was lost in his beard. Why, watch then, and I'll show you. With one finger, the lavishly monogrammed sheet of message parchment was thrust back into its slot. With a soft twang, it disappeared, and the globe was a smooth, unbroken hole again. Somewhere inside was the tiny oiled whir of the controls as they lost their setting by random movements. Now, there's no known way of opening this capsule without knowledge of Rios's personal characteristic, is there? To the Empire, no, said Barr. Then the evidence it contains is unknown to us and absolutely authentic. To the Empire, yes, said Barr. And the Emperor can open it, can't he? Personal characteristics of government officials must be on file. They are at the Foundation, at the Imperial Capital as well, agreed Barr. Then when you, a Sewenian patrician and peer of the realm, tell this Cleon, this emperor, that his favorite tame parrot and his shiniest general are getting together to knock him over and hand him the capsule as evidence, what will he think Broderick's ultimate ends are? Barr sat down weakly. Wait, I don't follow you. He stroked one thin cheek and said, You're not really serious, are you? I am. Devers was angrily excited. Listen, 9 out of the last 10 emperors got their throats cut or their gizzards blasted out by one or another of their generals with big-time notions in their heads. You told me that yourself more than once. Old man emperor would believe us so fast it would make Rios's head swim. Barr muttered feebly, He is serious. For galaxy's sake, man, you can't beat a Selden crisis by a far-fetched, impractical storybook scheme like that. Suppose you had never got hold of the capsule. Suppose Broderick hadn't used the word ultimate. Selden doesn't depend on wild luck. If wild luck comes our way, there's no law says Selden can't take advantage of it. Certainly, but... Barr stopped, then spoke calmly, but with visible restraint. Look, in the first place, how will you get to the planet Trantor? You don't know its location in space, and I certainly don't remember the coordinates, to say nothing of the ephemerae. You don't even know your own position in space. You can't get lost in space, grinned Devers. He was at the controls already. Down we go to the nearest planet, and back we come with complete bearings and the best navigation charts Broderick's 100,000 smackers can buy. And a blaster in our belly. Our descriptions are probably in every planet in this quarter of the Empire. Doc, said Devers patiently, don't be a hick from the sticks. Rios said my ship surrendered too easily, and brother, he wasn't kidding. This ship has enough firepower and enough juice in its shield to hold off anything we're likely to meet this deep inside the frontier. And we have personal shields, too. The Empire boys never found them, you know, but they weren't meant to be found. All right, said Barr. All right. Suppose yourself on Trantor. How do you see the Emperor, then? You think he keeps office hours? Suppose we worry about that on Trantor, said Devers. And Barr muttered helplessly, All right again. I've wanted to see Trantor before I die for half a century now. Have your way. The hyperatomic motor was cut in. The lights flickered, and there was the slight internal wrench that marked the shift into hyperspace.
Chapter 9. On Trantor. The stars were as thick as weeds in an unkempt field, and for the first time, Lathan Devers found the figures to the right of the decimal point of prime importance in calculating the cuts through the hyperregions. There was a claustrophobic sensation about the necessity for leaps of not more than a light year. There was a frightening harshness about a sky which glittered unbrokenly in every direction. It was being lost in a sea of radiation. And in the center of a cluster of 10,000 stars, whose light tore to shreds the feebly encircling darkness, there circled the huge imperial planet, Trantor. But it was more than a planet. It was the living pulse beat of an empire of 20 million stellar systems. It had only one function, administration, one purpose, government, and one manufactured product, law. The entire world was one functional distortion. There was no living object on its surface but man, his pets, and his parasites. No blade of grass or fragment of uncovered soil could be found outside the 100 square miles of the imperial palace. No water outside the palace grounds existed, but in the vast underground cisterns that held the water supply of a world. The lustrous, indestructible, incorruptible metal that was the unbroken surface of the planet was the foundation of the huge metal structures that mazed the planet. They were structures connected by causeways, laced by corridors, cubbyholed by offices, basemented by the huge retail centers that covered square miles, penthoused by the glittering amusement world that sparkled into life each night. One could walk around the world of Trantor and never leave that one conglomerate building, nor see the city. A fleet of ships, greater in number than all the war fleets the Empire had ever supported, landed their cargoes on Trantor each day to feed the 40 billions of humans who gave nothing in exchange but the fulfillment of the necessity of untangling the myriads of threads that spiraled into the central administration of the most complex government humanity had ever known. 20 agricultural worlds were the granary of Trantor. A universe was its servant. Already Devers had fumed his way through the manifold complications of a world conceived in paperwork and dedicated to the principle of the form in quadruplicate. There had been the preliminary halt in space, where the first of what had grown into 100 questionnaires had been filled out. There were the 100 cross-examinations, the routine administration of a simple probe, the photographing of the ship, the characteristic analysis of the two men, and the subsequent recording of the same, the search for contraband, the payment of the entry tax, and finally the question of the identity cards and visitor's visa. Dukembar was a Siwenian and subject of the Emperor, but Lathan Devers was an unknown without the requisite documents. The official in charge at the moment was devastated with sorrow, but Devers could not enter. In fact, he would have to be held for official investigation. From somewhere, 100 credits in crisp new bills, backed by the estates of Lord Broderick, made their appearance and changed hands quietly. The official hemmed importantly, and the devastation of his sorrow was assuaged. A new form made its appearance from the appropriate pigeonhole. It was filled out rapidly and efficiently, with the Devers characteristic thereto formally and properly attached. The two men, trader and patrician, entered Siwenna. In the hangar, the trade ship was another vessel to be cashed, photographed, recorded, contents noted, identity cards of passengers facsimiled, and for which a suitable fee was paid, recorded, and receipted. And then Devers was on a huge terrace under the bright white sun, along which women chattered, children shrieked, and men sipped drinks languidly, and listened to the huge televisions blaring out the news of the Empire. Barr paid a requisite number of iridium coins, and appropriated the uppermost member of a pile of newspapers. It was the Trantor Imperial News, official organ of the government. In the back of the newsroom, there was the soft clicking noise of additional editions being printed, in long-distance sympathy with the busy machines at the Imperial News offices, 10,000 miles away by corridor, 6,000 by air machine, just as 10 million sets of copies were being likewise printed at that moment in 10 million other newsrooms all over the planet. Barr glanced at the headlines and said softly, "What shall we do first?" Devers tried to shake himself out of his depression. He was in a universe far removed from his own,
on a world that weighed him down with its intricacy, among people whose doings were incomprehensible and whose language was nearly so. The gleaming metallic towers that surrounded him and continued onwards in never-ending multiplicity to beyond the horizon oppressed him. The whole busy, unheeding life of a world metropolis cast him into the horrible gloom of isolation and pygmyish unimportance. He said, "I better leave it to you, Doc." Barr was calm, low-voiced. "I tried to tell you, but it's hard to believe without seeing for yourself. I know that. Do you know how many people want to see the Emperor every day? About 1 million. Do you know how many he sees? About 10. We'll have to work through the civil service, and that makes it harder. But we can't afford the aristocracy. We have almost 100,000. A single peer of the realm would cost us that, and it would take at least 3 or 4 to form an adequate bridge to the Emperor. It may take 50 chief commissioners and senior supervisors to do the same, but they would cost us only 100 apiece, perhaps. I'll do the talking. In the first place, they wouldn't understand your accent, and in the second, you don't know the etiquette of imperial bribery. It's an art, I assure you. Ah." The third page of the Imperial News had what he wanted, and he passed the paper to Devers. Devers read slowly. The vocabulary was strange, but he understood. He looked up, and his eyes were dark with concern. He slapped the news sheet angrily with the back of his hand. "You think this can be trusted?" "Within limits," replied Barr calmly. "It's highly improbable that the Foundation fleet was wiped out. They've probably reported that several times already, if they've gone by the usual war reporting technique of a world capital, far from the actual scene of fighting. What it means, though, is that Rios has won another battle, which would be none too unexpected. It says he's captured Loris. Is that the capital planet of the Kingdom of Loris?" "Yes," brooded Devers. "Or of what used to be the Kingdom of Loris. And it's not 20 parsecs from the Foundation. Doc, we gotta work fast." Barr shrugged. "You can't go fast on Trantor. If you try, you'll end up at the point of an atom blaster, most likely." "How long'll it take?" "A month, if we're lucky. A month and our 100,000 credits, if even that will suffice. That is, providing the Emperor does not take it into his head in the meantime to travel to the summer planets, where he sees no petitioners at all. But the Foundation will take care of itself, as heretofore. Come, there's the question of dinner. I'm hungry. And afterwards, the evening is ours, and we may as well use it. We shall never see Trantor or any world like it again, you know." The Home Commissioner of the Outer Provinces spread his pudgy hands helplessly and peered at the petitioners with owlish nearsightedness. "But the Emperor is indisposed, gentlemen. It is really useless to take the matter to my superior. His Imperial Majesty has seen no one in a week." "He will see us," said Barr, with an affectation of confidence. "It is but a question of seeing a member of the staff of the Privy Secretary." "Impossible," said the Commissioner emphatically. "It would be the worth of my job to attempt that. Now, if you could but be more explicit concerning the nature of your business, I'm willing to help you understand, but naturally I want something less vague, something I can present to my superior as reason for taking the matter further." "If my business were such that it could be told to any but the highest," suggested Barr smoothly, "it would scarcely be important enough to rate audience with His Imperial Majesty. I propose that you take a chance. I might remind you that if His Imperial Majesty attaches the importance to our business, which we guarantee that he will, you will stand certain to receive the honors you will deserve for helping us now." "Yes, but..." And the Commissioner shrugged, wordlessly. "It's a chance," agreed Barr. "Naturally, a risk should have its compensation." This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.